I believe that the world we live in was first made, right? And so I think a big part of imagining other ways to be starts with the imagination, starts with what we write, starts with story.
This is the Paris Review podcast with a bonus episode featuring stories and poems that appeared in our summer and fall 2020 issues, number 233 and 234. Many of them are quite intense, just like the year was. And all were recorded during our virtual launch events over, what else, Zoom. In this episode, you'll hear Elegosa Osunde calling in from Lagos, Nigeria, Aracelis Germay reading two previously unpublished poems by Lucille Clifton, then Lydia Davis with a short story, translator Patricio Ferrari reading a poem by Antonio Osorio, Jamel Brinkley and Robbie Alamedine reading stories, Emma Hine with a new poem, and bits of conversation between Paris Review editor Emily Nemens and the authors. And now, the opening of Elegosa Osunde's Good Boy, a story in the voice of a young, queer Nigerian man who has faced violence and persecution and who has built his own community.
I've always had a problem with introductions. To me, they don't matter. It's either you know me or you don't. You get. If you don't, the main thing you need to know is that I'm a hustler through and through. I'm that guy that gets shit done, simple. Kick me out of the house at 15. A barged in on secret behind me. A heartbreak falling into my shin as I walk. And watch me grow some real useful muscles. Watch me learn how to play all the necessary games, good and ungood. Watch me learn how to notice red eyes, how to figure out when to squat and bite the road shoulder. Watch me learn why a good knife, and not just any kind of good, but the moral-less kind, the father-like kind, is necessary when you're sleeping under a bridge. Just a week after that, watch me swear on my own destiny and insist to the God who made me that I'm bigger than that lesson now. Then watch my Uri align. Watch me walk from that cursed bridge a free man and learn how to really make money between age damaged and age 22. Watch me pay the streets what I owe in blood and notes. Upfront, no installments. Watch me never lack where to sleep again. Second thing to know about me, I know how to make the crucial handshakes. Third thing, I know they make the same mistake twice. Almost evict me from my place in Surulere at age X, and watch rage stab me forward. Watch how in 3 weeks I treat my own fuck up with not just a room, but an apartment four times as big in Gagada. The how is irrelevant. Fourth thing, I'm serious about being alive. Because of this, there is nothing I can't survive. Anybody who knows me knows that. The rest agrees. It is my God-given right to be here. This life, me, I must chop on, and it must be on my own terms. What makes all of this worth it otherwise? Nothing. Someone I know joked just 2 days ago, said that even if I end up in hell at the end of the day, I won't stop kicking, I won't stop reaching for something. I will insist on my space. In reality, I'm not the kind of guy who ends up in a place like that because fifth thing. I'm not the kind of guy who believes in hell or in a God who imagines a lake of fire. I just can't see it. You have a mind that's wider than the sky, and that is what you use it to picture. To me, that sounds too petty, too human, too undivine to be real. People sell all kinds of gods all the time. I know the one that moves me, and it's not the one I was raised on. To me, you can't say you're love, choose to roast people for eternity, and then pretend it breaks your heart. Pick a side. Anyhow, the guy said the hell things make a point, and it's true. Luck finds my head. Business competes with my blood on who keeps me best, and either might fail depending on the day. So now, I always wonder, what do people want to use my name for? It won't buy you anything. Name drop me, and they'll still redirect you to me. In that sense, it's irrelevant to know. I answer a first name only, and it's for the people I know. But my story? Now that many people can do a whole lot with.
Poem to my yellow coat. Today I mourn my coat, my old potato, my yellow mother, my horse with buttons, my rind. Today she split her skin like a snake, refusing to excuse my back for being big, for being old, for reaching toward other cuffs and sleeves. She cracked like a whip and fell apart, my terrible teacher to the end. To hell with the arms you want, she hissed. Be glad when you're cold for the arms you have.
The left hand. The left hand prides itself on being more refined than the right hand. Yes, it is in fact a little slimmer, the knuckles are not as knobbly, and the skin is even a little smoother. But, says the right hand calmly, think of all the work I've done that you haven't over the years. Well, says the left, I've been there alongside you all the way, helping. But think of all the things you can't do that I can, says the right. Think of all the skills I've developed. The left hand hasn't worked as hard as the right. It is usually the assistant. It braces and steadies the carrot while the right hand cuts. It braces and steadies the notebook while the right hand writes. It braces and steadies the whole body in a crouching position while the right hand scrubs the floor or digs in the flower bed. True, there are some things they do together in a balanced way. For instance, they play the piano together. But here they are not equal. The left hand is quite effective at repeating a chord over and over, even a broken chord, but not very nimble in the 16th note passages. Not nearly as nimble as the right. The right hand points that out. Now the left hand is hurt. Its fourth finger has always been especially weak and can't move very independently. The left hand has always been frustrated and ashamed of how clumsily it plays. Though, in fact, the left hand is aware that by the highest standards, the right hand 16th notes are not all that even or fast. The right hand apologizes. It says, yes, sometimes you catch a thing that I've dropped, and you do turn off the water when I leave it on by mistake. Don't forget, says the left hand, still hurt, that you may be more skilled than I am with a knife. But the other day you sliced some skin off the top of my thumb. And remember that once you cut through my little finger so deep that I've permanently lost some feeling in it. That was years ago, says the right hand. Still, says the left, I'm the one you injure when you stop paying attention. I don't think you really care. Both hands wear rings. The left hand is proud that it wears a ring all the time and that the ring is gold. But the right hand is proud that it wears a ring on special occasions and that the ring was purchased in Europe. Some things they do together with equal skill, such as washing each other in the basin. Though it is true that the right hand is the one who reaches across for the soap while the left hand draws back out of the way. And, says the right hand, when we're rinsing, I make sure there's no soap under your ring. True, says the left hand, but on the evenings when you've worn your ring, I remove it while we're washing, I rinse it, I hold it while you dry it, and I put it away in the wooden box. But, says the right hand, I open the box. True, says the left hand. It is tired of arguing. It says to itself, don't we work together? Don't we learn from each other? The right hand could keep going with the argument. It is full of ideas and energy for more. But the left hand is silent. So that is the end of it. For now, anyway.
Creator of the beginning, Createra do inicio. Creator of the beginning, mud of death, endless wreckage. Is this your world, the serpent you forged over seven long nights? You were freshness in a well of cloistered water and the wondrous balance of sky over earth. I reject those hands, your fundamental bitterness, these corrodible eyes. Bastava um dia para construir esse mundo, mas saíste da costela do homem e ao seu lado sempre te afundas. Just one day for you to build a world, but you came from the rib of man and on his side continue to drown.
My sister threw open the door so that it banged against the little console table she kept by the entrance. Silas, she said breathlessly, before even removing her coat, I have to tell you something. Which was enough to make me feel trapped, as though the words out of her mouth were expanding and filling up the space in her tiny apartment. I told her to calm down and apologized, and then I began making excuses for myself. I had assumed she would be angry at me because of the previous night, so I was primed for what she might say when she got home from work. Don't be so defensive, Bernice said. I'm not talking about that. She tapped my legs so I would move them, and then plopped down next to me on the love seat. The chill from outside clung to her body. I saved my reformatted CV, set my laptop on the floor, and listened. The man who sang out of tune had been waiting for her again. He had started standing near the card shop on Amsterdam Avenue during her lunch hour 2 weeks earlier, and she had quickly noticed his repeated appearance. As she passed him that afternoon, he faced her directly and gave her a meaningful look, which was more than he had ever done before. But all he did after that was keep belting it out in that terrible voice, she told me. A sentimental song, you know, the sweetness of making love in the morning. Even though he was thin and light-skinned and wore those big clunky headphones, not my type at all, she said, Bernice did find him somewhat handsome. But since he didn't say anything, she just went inside the shop. She liked to go in there during her break because her job could be tough. She worked as a guidance counselor for high school kids, soaking up their troubles all day long. And the cards, however hackneyed or sentimental, gave her a daily boost she enjoyed. When she emerged a bit later, feeling affirmed, the man approached her. With the headphones clamped around his temples, his gloved fists tight around the straps of his backpack, he said he was sorry for bothering her, that he hoped she wouldn't mind. But he had seen her walk by the other day and thought, well, that she was beautiful. Meanwhile, she told me, with the kind of night I had, I'm sure I never looked worse a day in my life. She didn't shake the hand he offered, but smiled at how flustered he was. His name, which he said was Dove, pleased her, and the way he scrunched his lips together and shifted them from side to side had what she described to me as a clarifying effect. Bernice laughed now and said, so long story short, I said yes. What do you mean you said yes? I said. I gave him my actual name and my actual number, she said. He's a DJ and he has a gig this weekend. Maybe I'll go see him do his thing. I couldn't tell if she was being serious. You think I'm crazy, she said. I don't, I said reflexively, but only somewhat honestly. I knew that she found our mother's warnings to avoid men on the street excessive. She told me once that doing so would be like forbidding the use of a shower because water could get hot and scald. Bernice didn't want to be seen as weak, and she always trusted her own instincts. I didn't have much faith in them, though. In my mind, she could be reckless. The previous night, she had texted and called me in a panic, but I wasn't available for her. I was out with a woman when my phone lit up, so for a long time, I ignored Bernice's texts, her calls, and her voicemails, too. The truth was, I found my sister exhausting, the way she could crowd you out of her life with the enormity of her own. The entanglement I was trying to have with that woman, I told myself, was too urgent to be interrupted. I didn't find out what had happened until the morning, when I finally listened to her messages and read her texts. By then, she was already on her way to work. Unable to reach me last night, she requested a car to drive her to the emergency room. She sat in the dingy waiting area for a long time before she was able to meet with a doctor. And she told him what she told me in the first voicemail. I don't know what it is, but I just feel off. I can't think straight. And my body, it doesn't feel right. She had texted me again afterwards saying that her blood pressure was elevated. But in the doctor's opinion, her issues overall seemed minor, most likely stress related. All she needed to do was relax. So, I said, now, you feeling okay? As the heat hissed steadily into the room, I looked down at the love seat, where I had been sleeping for weeks while enduring a job search. Perhaps foolishly, I was hell-bent on being in New York, but it seemed like every other American in the country was too. Bernice had offered to let me stay with her until I got my bearings and found something. I already told you, she said, the doctor says I'm fine. So you're fine, I said. I guess so. That's good, I said. I mean, I'm glad. I mean it. But they shooed me away, Silas, Bernice said, her voice growing large. You should have seen it. It all happened so fast. I didn't even get a chance to explain. When she saw the smirk on my face, she glared. What's so funny? You're doing really well with the whole relaxing thing, I said. Terrific job. Truly top notch. She nudged my shoulder with hers. Well, I'll be doing plenty of relaxing with my new friend, Dove, if he plays his cards right. That's awful, I said. That's just too much. You always are saying too much. Doesn't matter how much you talk, if people don't listen, she said. I picked at the edge of my borrowed pillow. The love seat faced the door to the apartment, and next to it, above the table, hung a framed photograph taken by our late father, of our mother and us when she was a young woman. In it, Bernice is three, cranky from an ear infection, and I am a frowning infant in her lap. Sitting beside us on a stiff-looking blue sofa, wearing a pale summer dress, our mother smiles with her teeth. "Well, let me ask you this," I said suddenly now, in a brassy imitation of her. "Was that doctor you saw a white doctor?" "Oh, God," my sister said. "Of course he was." She began shaking her head, and we both laughed. I should have remembered what she always says. What was it again? "You remember," I said. "But when it comes to those white doctors," Bernice cried, now imitating our mother, "always, always exaggerate the pain."
The first refugee was my sister, Nadia. After the Israelis bombed the airport, she and my one-year-old nephew, cheeks still swollen with sleep, arrived with three suitcases in tow. One contained her clothes and belongings, the second her son's clothes, and the third was bursting with disposable diapers. She lived only three buildings away, nowhere near the airport, but we knew it wouldn't take her long to come over. We didn't have to ask where her husband was. "He can stay where he is," she huffed. "The Israelis have sophisticated weapons. I don't have to be there when one of their missiles finds him." My sister had married a Shiite. "You shouldn't be saying that," my father said. "Your husband is a good man, a wonderful man." We all loved my brother-in-law, but Nadia found him annoying. She had been completely obsessed with him before the wedding, but not after. I found the situation, her constant irritation with her husband, somewhat confounding. He was decent, intelligent, and admirably gentle. Not the most interesting man, one had to admit, but consistent, if anything. How a wedding could change her opinion so abruptly wasn't easy to explain. I assumed the intimacy and mundaneness of marriage had surprised her, and she had yet to recover. It could have been worse since he traveled quite a bit, being a commercial pilot. Still, she complained that he wasn't gone enough. My mother defended her by reminding everyone that she was a young bride and would grow up in time. My sister rolled her suitcase into the old room, which she hadn't allowed anyone to claim when she moved out, understandably, since she still spent most of her days in our apartment. I followed her, carrying my nephew, and put him on his cot, under its ever-circling wooden airplanes. I moved my sister's old stuffed toys around to create space for him. The walls were baby pink, the color of her nail polish and lipstick. She avoided dark shades, claiming they emphasized the puffy aspects of her lips. "Watch him," Nadia said. "I have to go hoarding." "Your brother should go with you," my mother said. "He can carry. I'll stay here, but don't forget anything." The entire country was on the road. It happened every time the Israelis bombed Beirut. Never when they shelled the south, which they did on a more regular basis. Bombing the airport during high season, though, meant that every tourist was driving out of the city and out of the country. My father raged against the traffic, and when we passed a gas station, he banged his head on the steering wheel. After dropping us off at the supermarket, he'd have to wait in line for at least a couple of hours to fill up the tank. Wajdi, who had taken my mother's car, was probably stuck at a station already. "I hate this," my father yelled. "Are you sure we need to do this?" I asked. "The Israelis won't stop. They never do. It's the right of the privileged. They're always the victims, which means they're going to rain the demons of hell upon us. He took deep breaths, trying to fill his lungs with calm. It rarely worked. Bomb everything. Kill hundreds, thousands. Does anyone take any responsibility? Feel guilty? They blame everyone but themselves. My father's heart found some relief in diatribes. He raged every time the Israelis attacked us, less at the actual casualties and damage than at their lack of concern. This time, my father was going to rage for quite a while. My sister and I split up in the supermarket. I reveled in the excitement of upheaval, stacking my shopping cart with cases of drinking water, cartons of cigarettes for my father, sacks of flour, bulgur, and coffee. She would get everything else if we were lucky, since the market was emptying quickly. People had begun hoarding the evening before. The Lebanese had a lot of experience. I was deciding how much rice to buy when I heard my sister shriek 2 aisles away. I rushed over, pushing my cart, finding her in the baby aisle. She held a package of Pampers as a tall, better manicured woman in a tailored day dress tried to snatch it away. The woman blabbered and kept jerking her recently coiffed head at 2 packages of Huggies in my sister's car as if she had a neurotic twitch. My sister's fingers had punctured the plastic. Several strands of her hair had escaped their beret. Customers whispered, not bothering to hide their sniggering. The woman's Filipina maid in a baby blue uniform watched the melee with her hand over her mouth. The maid and her mistress must have shared a hairdresser because they had the exact same coif, the latter in a much lighter tone, of course. They both had sweaters tied around their shoulders. Nadia tugged and pulled and screeched. The woman finally released her grip. "You have 3 packages," she said, shocked at not getting what she wanted. "Give me one of them." My sister snorted as she put the last package of Pampers in her cart. She turned her back and pushed her cart away. "Let's go," she said when she saw me. The woman whispered to her maid, who nodded, then rushed my sister's cart, grabbed a diaper package, and disappeared down another aisle, the blue sweater floating on air like a hero's cape. My sister screamed, tried to spring her cart around to follow the maid's cooling trail, but other customers got in the way. The woman laughed, beamed. I expected her to shout, "Who's the fairest of them all?"
Cassandra. It's time to leave again. She unplugs the fridge and watches until the orange coils on its back have faded down to gray. She turns off the gas. She papers the windows in layers from the outside, because if she doesn't, the moon will reflect in the panes like a lamp in every room. And then the house will still seem lived in. And then how to move on? The last thing she does, always, is go with them one by one into their rooms and hold them up to pluck the glow-in-the-dark stars from the ceiling. They place the stars inside a wooden box, which is what they are, her children. Little hinged boxes full of a chemical that makes light out of nothing, that glows all on its own. They're wearing coats over their patterned pajamas. When the stars are away, the house is completely dark, and somehow the sounds are louder. The final shut of the door, the porch steps, the frogs like small rocks clacking in the tree's throat. In the yard's farthest corner, she asks her children what they can see. As always, they say, "Nothing." The house could be invisible. It could have shrunk to the size of a blackberry. The hill could have grown up to swallow it. It might have changed into a tree. She's relieved. She can still see it so clearly, like the retinal burn of a light bulb long after it's been turned off. Like all their other houses, the already and the not yet ranged like old flares across the hills. She starts walking and her children follow. They're mimicking a screech owl, then listening, because if they call in the right voice, something might call back. Before long, they'll be climbing the hill to the new house, opening the unlocked door, claiming bedrooms. then waiting for her to reattach the constellations, asking, is this a cat, a cave, a sleeping bear, a little spoon? And they won't know, and she won't be able to correct them. And soon she'll unwrite the stars again, and they'll go on.
You were in the archive with Camilla Aisha Moon looking through Clifton's papers. What did it feel like to encounter new work, things you hadn't seen before? What were the two of you thinking? What were you saying? I'd love to just hear about that moment.
It was really special, and I could feel her work, Clifton's work, bringing me closer to other people, even my beloved. So we were just astonished. We read things out loud. We laughed really hard. We paid attention to every detailed drawings that her kids made on the sides of the margins. We read together and asked each other questions about what the poems made us think. So I do feel like it felt almost like a wedding ceremony of sisterhood somehow. Bouquet. I have gathered my losses into a spray of pain. My parents, my brother, my husband, my innocence, all clustered together, durable as daisies. Now I add you, little love, little flower, who walked unannounced into my life and almost blossomed there.
This concludes our bonus episode of the Paris Review podcast. You heard the opening portion of Good Boy, a short story written and read by Elagosa Osunde, Poem to My Yellow Coat, a previously unpublished poem by Lucille Clifton, read by Araceli Skirmay, The Left Hand, a short story written and read by Lydia Davis, Crater of the Beginning, a poem by Antonio Osorio, read by the translator Patricio Ferrari. An excerpt from Witness, a story written and read by Jamel Brinkley. An excerpt from The July War, a story written and read by Robbie Alamedine. Cassandra, a poem written and read by Emma Hine. We concluded with Araceli Skirmay saying a few words about Lucille Clifton, whose selected poems, How to Carry Water, she edited, followed by her reading of Clifton's poem, Bouquet. Thank you to the Paris Review's Julia Barrick for coordinating these readings, and to the rest of the review staff for making everything we do possible. Visit theparisreview.org/events to watch videos of these two readings and to sign up for future events. Thank you as well to Stitcher, our production partner for the Paris Review podcast. This episode was produced by Emily Nemens and me, Craig Morgan Teicher, at the Paris Review, and mixed and sound designed by Helena de Groot, with special thanks to the Nigerian sound artist Emeka Ogbo, who let us use his Lagos soundscapes. Original music was composed and performed by David Sieri, Emily Wells, Mike Brown, Sam Ospavat, Rob Schwimmer, Shahzad Ismaili, and Casey Holford. Our theme song was composed by David Sieri. We're at work on season 3 of the podcast and look forward to taking you on more literary odysseys soon. Don't forget to visit theparisreview.org, where you can subscribe to the print quarterly and our email newsletters. If you like this episode, we hope you'll subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.